Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this domestic abuse and COVID-19 discussion panel. Really pleased to have a fantastic panel of speakers joining us today. I'll introduce everybody one by one and give them the opportunity just to say a few words about who they are and what they do, and then we'll crack on with some of the discussion. So, firstly, I'll pass over to Jackie McHugh, who's representing Restorative Solutions. Good afternoon, Jackie.
Good afternoon, Matthew. Thank you very much. Yes, my name is Jackie McHugh, and I am head of Restorative Justice Service for Kent and Medway, which is a service that has been commissioned by Matthew Scott. We are currently also piloting an adolescent parent violence scheme, which is in its very early sort of inception at the moment. I think we've been running about 4 weeks now, but is really getting an awful lot of interest from Kent and from other services within Kent and Barents. So that's myself, really. The Restorative Justice Service for Kent is really well used, and we use it both for domestic violence and sexual offences as well, which is quite unusual. I think we were one of the first, but I'm hearing from across the country that a lot of other services are now delivering the same service. So that's really, really positive.
That's great to hear, and welcome again. Henu Cummins is Chief Executive of DAVS. Welcome.
Thank you, Matthew. It's a pleasure to be here today. So, as Matthew said, my name is Henu Cummins. I'm Chief Executive Officer of DAVS. We're Domestic Abuse Volunteer Support Services. We're based in Tunbridge Wells in West Kent, where we provide vital support services to anyone over the age of 16. So that's women as well as men experiencing domestic abuse in the local authority areas of Tunbridge Wells, Tunbridge and Morling, and Sevenoaks. We're a small independent charity, but Mr. Scott and his team fund a few of our support projects. So that's the Support to Court project, which is unique in Kent, and it's run alongside a unique volunteering model, where our volunteer advisors as well as staff will go to court and apply for orders for individuals who are experiencing domestic abuse who can't quite navigate the criminal and civil justice system by themselves. And the other project that Mr. Scott currently funds is the Men Male Victim project, which we know men experiencing domestic abuse, it's harder for them to come forward, as one of our colleagues here will explain a little bit more about. But so we specifically target run a targeted campaign to enable men to come forward, along with a whole heap of other projects that we run internally as well. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you again and welcome.
Thank
And
you.
finally, it's Mark Brooks, OBE, who's Chairman of Trustees of the Mankind Initiative. Welcome, Mark.
Well, thank you very much, Matthew, and thank you everyone for allowing me to come on today. So I'm Mark Brooks, as Matthew mentioned. I'm the chair of the Mankind Initiative charity, and we support male victims of domestic abuse right across the UK, run a national helpline, train lots of organisations on how to better support male victims, and also make sure that their voice is heard in Parliament and elsewhere.
Thanks, Mark. As you will have heard from our panel, these are all charities which I've worked with in one way or another, both locally and nationally. And it was really important for me as part of the work that I do as PCC to reach out to all of these organisations during the lockdown because, as you may have heard during the course of the last 4 months of lockdown, domestic abuse is a key issue for victims and for policing and the wider criminal justice service. What we've seen here in Kent is something which many other police forces will have reported, and sadly, that has meant an increase in the number of calls to police incidents. In some weeks, an increase of 40% compared to the year before, and also an increase in the number of crimes which are being recorded. And part of the tragedy around some of that, one is that it's happening. The good thing is those people are coming forward and receiving support. We still don't know the full breadth of what's out there from a policing perspective. And it's important to talk to charities like those who I've brought together today to understand what trends we've seen during the course of the last 4 months, what learning has been made, and how we can all work together. Because even before COVID-19, domestic abuse accounted for around 1 in 5 recorded crimes in Kent, around 45,000 every single year. And that is a much higher number than there ever was before, more than double. So that does place a demand on policing, but it does mean that we have to make sure that we're doing absolutely everything we can for those victims, whether they are male or female, whether they are in LGBT relationships or whatever the circumstances, that we're here for everybody. And I hope that today is an opportunity for the organisations I brought together to share their perspectives with you, for you to, as people who are watching on Facebook, thanks to those who are already joining us, and maybe those who are going to be watching this subsequently, to ask questions, to come forward, but also to remember, if you know someone who is in danger or you're in danger yourself, please contact Kent Police, phone 999 in emergency, but please do reach out, please do speak out, and make sure that you get the support that you need. I aim to make this event a discussion, really, and there are a couple of key points which the panellists know I was keen to touch on, but also to come back to Jacqueline in a bit to talk about the new project which is arisen out of the last few months. So I'll come to you first, Henny, because obviously you do projects which are both male and female victims. I'm assuming that you will have seen the same increase in levels of demand for your services, but how's your team found the lockdown? What kind of things have you been seeing?
So yeah, absolutely. I think it's important to say to our viewers that obviously domestic abuse comes with a health warning. So some of the things you might hear aren't necessarily pretty. And if anything affects you, then please, as Mr. Scott said, please do reach out and seek help. And obviously we're all available as charities and the police as well. But so I think the first couple of weeks in lockdown, we saw a small dip where I think people were adjusting to life differently, in a different way of doing things. But within a couple of weeks, we saw a colossal increase in the number of calls coming through to the helpline. What was more alarming was almost every single one of those calls reaching us were of an urgent nature. So where we would ordinarily see a usual spread of medium and standard risk cases, we were seeing almost every single one coming through of a high risk and high need nature, needing immediate crisis intervention, i.e. individuals who were in life-threatening life crisis situations. And as you can imagine, that's been an incredibly tough period for our staff and our advisors. It's meant that we've had to increase the number of advisors available on the helpline. We've doubled the number of hours available. We've made the website accessible. We've made more volunteers available on the helpline. We've spent longer per case. So our volunteer advisors have spent 78% longer per case, providing people with the support that they need. And what we have been told is, this is my one chance to call because I'm now in a situation where I cannot escape my abuser. So please don't hang up on me. Not that we would any bit, but we found the people calling were absolutely desperate and at their wit's end. So a lot of people coming through were saying, had it not been for COVID, I probably wouldn't have accessed help because I would have just got on with my life. But COVID has exasperated my situation and it's now unbearable. So it's been pretty intense, and life on the front line of a DA charity has been pretty grim. Our advisors have doubled the number of hours they've been giving, and our staff, and there's not that many paid staff in over here at DAVS, have all given their time freely to redesign the services to ensure that every single call coming through is receiving the highest quality service. And that's obviously possible with emergency funding that we've received from not only Mr. Scott's office, but lots of other places that have enabled us to continue providing that support. So it's been tough.
And how's that been for the volunteers and the employees themselves? Because obviously you mentioned they're all doing extra. Yeah. How do you manage that impact upon them?
It's been tough. We've increased the number of clinical supervision sessions available for our clients, for our staff and volunteers. We've been working with local agencies and organisations to provide counselling services, not just for the clients coming through, but actually for the advisors who are day in, day out, hour after hour, hearing these really incredible pleas for help and cries for help, where people don't necessarily feel like there's an escape to this situation. So managers have had to be more available to the advisors, and we've all had to be more available to one another, encourage open discussion. And as lockdown is easing a little bit more, we've actually preempted some situations and asked individuals to take holiday, take leave, because we understand that there's a high burnout rate in this arena, and that's what we're seeing. So and not only that, we've actually had to increase the number of advisors. So we've recruited 13 new advisors and 3 new members of staff, so that we can rotate to give people a break, because otherwise it's pretty relentless, pretty intense.
I can imagine. And Mark, from as a charity which does work nationally, you receive referrals from all around the country. Mm. What kind of thing have you been seeing, and how has that impacted upon your helplines?
Well, I mean, not only on our helpline, also we have a kind of practitioners group that support practitioners of organisations around the country. They feed into us, and we have discussions very much similar to this. And I think just a very similar pattern, that there was certainly a dip in terms of referrals coming to us and other organisations, but then it really ramped up. In our helpline, I mean, certainly we've seen our calls have gone up by a third, and that still continues to be the same pattern. We know other national helplines support men have had the same. And what's always the issue is that the more capacity you put on, the more people actually get help. And what it has shown is that pre-COVID, there was a huge amount of demand for services that actually wasn't being met. And now there is more resources coming into the sector. Actually, more people are able to get help. One of the things that has changed is really the flavour of some of the calls that we've had. I mean, we've had a big increase in men who are fathers who have said that they're no longer having been allowed contact with their children when they've had pre-arranged child arrangement orders or contact orders, and that the mothers are saying you can't see your children anymore, or during COVID, and therefore that's causing quite a lot of psychological and emotional abuse. I'm sure it's happening the other way around, but of course our helpline's male victims, so therefore it's men who are calling us. A lot of men also who haven't been able to access mental health services, which aren't necessarily domestic abuse related, but they've had counselling appointments cancelled, or they've not been able to access mental health trusts, etc. So they're ringing any helpline anywhere to actually get just to speak to somebody. And I'm sure that's the same on things like Samaritans and all sorts of other helplines, local and national. But the other thing that's really been concerning us is really this intensification of domestic abuse that's happening, because there's no respite to it, because you're literally stuck with your perpetrator 24/7. And what we're really concerned about is the long-term psychological impact that will have on all victims, not only just now, but in the future. And I'll be honest, on a weekly basis now, we are being contacted primarily via mothers and sisters about men who've committed suicide because of domestic abuse. I mean, I had I had an email only a few days ago, and that is a pattern that's always been there, but it's never been as intensive as it is now. So the calls are going up, but the flavour of those calls, some of the issues that have been raised, are different than before.
That's interesting to hear, particularly around the mental health element, because that mirrors something that came up during the last one of these panel discussions, which was specifically on that issue. the mix of domestic abuse, and I know this is something that your charity campaigns on, Mark, with withholding of access being considered abuse as well, but also the impact on individuals' mental health and suicidal ideation has been quite substantial. COVID anxiety, a new term which has come out of the last few months. And actually, interestingly, just as we were talking about that, Denise has come in with a comment around this issue, actually. And if you are watching us, please feel free to leave your comments in the Facebook group. We will try to address those where we possibly can and try and point you in the right direction if you need support. Charities cannot currently be contacted. They're very busy or they can't accommodate because of COVID. A friend is living in a caravan on her drive at the end of her tether because of mental abuse, and she can get no help. She's living on a run of fruit a day. And I think that demonstrates, you know, some of the challenges which individuals are having in not being able to flee from their perpetrator. Denise, we will, through this, make contact with you and try and see if we can do something to help your friend, whether she's a Kent resident or whether she's not. But please do feel free, if you are watching, to get involved in and comment in the chat section. Jacqueline, obviously COVID-19 has impacted, as many people have said, on their regular business. But obviously, as you mentioned at the outset, you tried to set up a new project during the course of the last few months as well around this important subject. And one of the reasons I was keen to have you on to talk about it. Could you talk us a little bit more about how you came to set the project up, what the inspiration behind it was, and what some of the early impact that you are having?
Yes, thank you, Matthew. Obviously, domestic abuse has always been quite a significant element of the Restorative Justice Service. At the outset of the shutdown and COVID, our referrals were hugely affected because we always tend to get them, obviously, at a later date. We're not the first call, if you like, when somebody is experienced difficulties, but we tend to get involved at a later stage where people are beginning, have gone through the criminal justice system and are beginning to look at getting answers and being able to repair their self, not the relationship, definitely not, but that actually, you know, being able to get answers for themselves. However, it's always been clear, and I'm sure this is sort of UK-wide, that there is a significant issue around adolescent parent violence. We, prior to lockdown, used to get quite a few referrals where it might be a case that it would be the first incident that had been reported by police, or perhaps this has been going on for some time within the family and it's the first or second time that they've had to call police because they've just come to the end of their tether. And so we were very lucky to be included in trying to pilot a service where we could begin to offer some support for families who at this particular time are going through very, very difficult times. The whole situation where you've got, particularly in the beginning, where you had young people that were being kept at home, not going to school, was an absolute tinderbox for an awful lot of families. And parents will often say, you know, we just don't know what to do. We don't know what to do for the best. We don't want to call police on our son, daughter, whatever, but we don't know what else to do. You know, we can't get that immediate response from anybody else at the moment, and things are escalating and we just don't know what to do. So we sort of wanted to look at how we could deliver a service in the current circumstances. And our hope is that, you know, once, well, as lockdown restrictions being lifted, we're already changing it, but it's a service, the model for the service is moving, if you like. So at the first instance, what we decided is that the service would be open to all young people and families with children between the ages of 10 and 18. And that in the first instance, we would offer an online service whereby we would contact both the young person and the parent, either through Zoom or through WhatsApp or through telephone or whatever the media that they felt most comfortable with, to try and sort of establish what was going on, to make sure all parties were safe. That's obviously number one priority. And really to try and listen and understand what was going on for the family. We're finding that families, you know, particularly parents, are absolutely crying out for this type of support. They just want somebody that they can pretty much offload to try. It's not about fixing it for them. We're not there to actually fix what's going on within the family, but it's about communication. And often families are so entrenched in what's going on and the incidents that are going on that they've gone beyond being able to communicate with each other. So where it is voluntary, so obviously both parties have to agree to take part. And where they do, we then offer a sort of one-to-one preparation meeting with both the young person and the parent or parents. We are looking at, you know, what's happened in that incident, the most recent incident that's going on. It's not about blame. It's not about forgiveness. It's about actually trying to unpick what is going on within that family. And as anybody that works with families will know, you know, it can very often be something really quite minor or very serious that is actually underpinning what is going on within that family unit. And it's a very structured process. So restorative justice, for those of you that, you know, may know something about it, it is a very structured process. So we are trying to deliver what would be an ordinary restorative justice conference, but we're trying to do it remotely. So Zoom has been absolutely wonderful. Obviously, you can set up a lot of things with that. We can have breakout rooms. We can have, so if, you know, if things get a little bit heated under the collar, which they often can do within families, we were very concerned about that. We were concerned that actually, because we'd be doing things remotely, that there was the potential for families, because they would be in the same venue, probably they would still be in their home address, and we were quite sort of worried that actually it might have the potential to make things worse. But so far we've found, with all of the safeguarding that we've put in, with all of the risk assessment that we've put in, that it's working really, really well. Provided that preparation is done really well, we have very firm boundaries about what we're going to talk about within that conference situation. And it gives people the chance, particularly young people, to actually tell their parent what's going on for them, tell their parent what it is that they're finding difficult, and what's making them angry. And it also gives the opportunity for the parent or the, you know, the carer to actually let the young person know the effect that their behaviour is having on them. Because often young people just don't accept that, you know, when they, I don't know, perhaps when they're mum, or when they start to get quite aggressive with mum or dad, but actually they don't understand how that makes that parent or that carer feel. That, you know, for them it's just a one-off incident, but they don't really understand that how that makes that parent feel. So because it's a very structured format, both sides get the opportunity to actually talk about what is going on for them. And what we're finding is that where both parties are willing to take part and are keen to you know, engage with the facilitator, the families have lost in these situations some of that communication, and that they're really not aware of how the other party feels. And it's been quite revolutionary when we've had a successful conference between both parties, where people have constantly said, and that's on both parties, I didn't know that, I wasn't aware of that, I didn't know that was how that made you feel. And so it's about trying to get this early, trying to step in with families early to give them or to help them develop that communication between both parties. One of the things that we're, you know, we have said from the outset is that the family has to have some other form of support within, you know, already offered for that family. So they have to have an early help worker or a social worker, because there may be some form of fallout from having the conference, and we want to make sure that they've got that support network there, that once, you know, we've started up to unpick what's going on, that actually we don't just leave them and say, oh, well, thank you very much, we've done our bit, and off we go. So we, you know, we need to make sure that they've already got family support from an outside agency to be able to deliver that. But you know, the message we're getting from parents is that they're absolutely desperate for some form of support in this, you know, in this instance, because, you know, everybody's housed up. It's a complete hothouse environment. And although it was always a bubbling problem within Kent, that is, and you know, obviously UK-wide as well, but that is definitely something that, you know, what we hear constantly is, thank goodness that we've got somebody that we can, you know, talk to, that we can talk through this. And even, because sometimes it can be really quite difficult to engage the young person, even if the young person doesn't want to engage with the process, it's been really, really positive for the parent to be able to offload and talk about a lot of what's going on. It's not about, you know, we're not there to give them, you know, the coping mechanism, the tips. That's obviously what the early help worker or the social, you know, the social care support is there for. But for them to have somebody who is a non-judgmental ear is very, very positive for them.
Thanks for that. That's really fantastic to hear that, the impact of that. And I mean, there was obviously quite a clear need, and we see that in amongst the casework that we receive and the calls which are coming into police, so that you've been able to get all of that going and in such a challenging environment as well is a real, real positive. And obviously, Zoom was mentioned in there quite a lot. Obviously, there's been a takeoff of Zoom and Teams, and I think investors in Skype will be quite disappointed that they've sort of missed out on this on this revolution. But Mark, how have you coped with what people are dealing, the Zoom revolution?
well, for those of us who when we were at university used to write our essays out in longhand, trying to go with the technology has been a bit of a revelation. But I mean the organisation has been able to operate. I mean, we've still been able to operate our helpline. Our staff are classed as essential workers, and they've been happy, and we've obviously complied with all the government guidelines. And we have a couple of staff who've been able to work at home. Some of the other aspects, in terms of the things that we've done with regard to training and presentations, obviously that's changed a bit to being online. So I think we've been able to cope. I think the technology has helped. I mean, if Zoom and MS Teams wasn't around, say, if this happened 2 or 3 years ago, then I think it would have been a big problem for so many organisations, irrelevant of whether in our sector or not. So we've been fortunate in that respect. But our teams have been able to cope, and certainly the sense we get from other organisations is that they've been able to adapt pretty quickly.
And Henu, obviously you've been doing a lot of work to adjust to this, and obviously you work in a police station your charity is based at. How have you found that transition?
I think it's been a complete cultural shift, to be honest, because one of the unique things that we do at DAVS is provide that face-to-face support. We're renowned for that. We know that domestic abuse can't be solved in a 6-week and a 10-week and a 12-week model. So because we have a unique volunteering model where we use the local community to support the needs of the local individuals. We draw people from the local community, we train them up there to a professional level, and they go out into the community, they meet individuals. That's been a complete shift to take that, pull that all back, and then all of a sudden go to supporting people on the telephone and not quite getting the depth and breadth of what they're going through because they can't quite explain it, or you know, there's children at home, there's the perpetrator's just gone out for 10 minutes or 20 minutes and they're very time limited. It has been tough. It has been a real adjustment for our advisors. It's been really difficult not want to give your all to that client because you can see they're completely and utterly desperate. We've seen a colossal increase, like Mark said, in men coming forward who have had no access to their children, who we've had, you know, women coming forward who've said their partners have enforced them into shielding and have used COVID as a legitimate excuse in their eyes. We've been having to hear a lot of these harrowing instances. And then not only that, one of the unique things we do at DABS is provide each other with that moral support, and we have been able to do that. And we have used those platforms. It doesn't ever take away from that face-to-face support. But it's been a it's been a useful platform nonetheless to be able to provide that support. And we don't use Zoom or MS Teams to provide support to clients. It is only phone based because we think it's quite difficult to be able to have them sit down and essentially pour their heart out, do an official assessment that classes them at a certain risk, and then we make all these signpost them to lots of different agencies and organisations and take their cases to MARUC. Mm-hmm. It's a lot to get done without that face-to-face meeting. So on the whole, cases take a lot longer, where they might have been solved or they might have been dealt with via particular parameters. It's not happening at the moment. And not only that, prior to COVID, where we had a lot of clients who were sort of okay. You know, we'd done a lot of work with them, didn't we? We'd done a lot of crisis intervention. They were moving on to the next stages, and I hate to use the phrase to the journey to recovery. They were. Those things were bubbling back up again because all of a sudden they were starting back again from square one. They were back in enforcement. They were back having to speak to their abusive partners, perhaps because of children. Perhaps the sale of the matrimonial home had come to an end. Perhaps they, you know, one of the projects we run is to go to court. The orders were taking a little bit longer, then they were over the phone, they were cancelled. So there was a lot of adjustment for our clients, and I have to pay tribute to their courage because it has been really tough for them as well to have that adjustment, and also to the wonderful people that prop charities and agencies and organisations like ours up.
That's great to hear. Please do.
Sorry, Matt. I think you're absolutely right, Hannah. I don't think we can ever pretend that this remote world that we're living in any substitute for the face-to-face work that, you know, hopefully we're now doing socially distanced meetings that now we're working towards. But one of the positives that we found is young people, particularly in the restorative justice world, can be quite difficult to engage. It's quite difficult particularly talking about the APV pilot, that it's often very difficult for young people. It's difficult for everybody, or most people, to actually take responsibility and admit when you've done something wrong. And when you offer them that face-to-face meeting, that they're often very reluctant to take part because, you know, for many reasons. But one of the things that sort of strangely, perhaps not sort of not as unexpected as it might be, but one of the things that we've discovered is that often young people will be happier to engage with us via Zoom or WhatsApp because that's their world. So it might not be, it doesn't work very well for older people or for those of us like you, Mark, that would have written their essays longhand, but it most definitely seems to encourage some younger people to get involved, whether it's because it gives them a little bit of remoteness from the situation, whether they feel that they're not quite as exposed to the process. I don't know. Obviously, it would never be my ideal situation, but certainly they seem to be more willing to speak to us and engage with the facilitator than they may have been through the face-to-face. So, you know, whilst I do not want to remain in this sort of situation, if there's anything that we can take away from that, actually, you know, we have learned that there are other ways of engaging people in the process, and that we just don't have to rely on that face-to-face meeting.
Thank you, all of you. That's really, really helpful to hear. I've had a question come in from Barbara. How's the impact of COVID-19 lockdown been on the children who have probably witnessed more violence in the home? This is obviously a really important area, as we all acknowledge when we look at long-term issues such as adverse childhood experiences, but also some of the other issues like the listening to the voice of the child as probably the person who maybe phoned in the first place. Henu, how do you see this issue of children being witnesses to it?
Sure, Matthew. So I think, excuse my colleagues outside, they're obviously very busy, but if I shut the window, I will boil in this building. So one of the things we always say is that children don't actually witness and they experience it. They're in it, they're living in that situation, it's current, they're going through it. So we run adverse childhood experience and children's freedom courses for children, and that was due to very, very high demand. So when I first started in Dads, I sat down and spoke to mums and dads, non-abusive mums and dads, who all sat down and said, it's all very well, there's a lot of support packages around for myself. However, I worry about the long-term impact on my children because they've gone through it, they've lived through it. And as much as I can be nurturing and loving, I'm dealing with my own demons, and is there someone who can help them? So we've started running these courses. We ran them successfully last year, and it teaches young people to understand that it's not okay and it's not their fault, and what they're going through is not normal. And often in these really disruptive households, that person who's facilitating and leading that course is their one touch base with normalcy, with reality. Like, that's an adult, and I've just made a mistake, but they haven't shouted at me, or they haven't screamed at me, and they haven't screamed at the other person. So we're trying to introduce some of that back into children's lives. And the other thing we're doing is, as Mark said, a lot of parents are having to go through the court system to gain access to their children. And all of a sudden, children are exposed to this world where a lady or a man from Kafkas comes and speaks to them, and they're like, who is this person who I'm not allowed to speak to strangers, but yet I have to speak to this person? And then a judge asks me a question, and this person sits there and asks me questions. So we one of our advisors will call and speak to age-appropriate children and explain to them the process and demystify some of that experience. And we often see them face-to-face. Obviously, prior to COVID, we were seeing them face-to-face. So we have to ramp up the support that we're providing to children, because they're tomorrow's future and they're the ones that are experiencing it. One of the things we propagate is break the silence, break that cycle of abuse, teach them young. So early intervention and sustained programs of education to try and break that cycle is the way forward for us and for a lot of DA agencies and organisations.
Thank you. We're going to wrap it up with my final question in just a moment, but just a couple of thank yous to people who have left comments on Facebook. Danielle Hoynes, thank you very much for the information with regards to people who may be having fears about what would happen to their pets. Cats Protection run a scheme in the southeast called Paws Protect, where cats are fostered free of charge for an indefinite period. And you can find out more information about that on the Cats Protection League website and also in the comment section here on Facebook. And also a wave across to the other end of the country to Alison Hernandez, who's the PCC for Devon and Cornwall, saying thank you for keeping this issue in all of our minds. Again, this is a really crucial issue that we have to continue talking about. And if people might well be interested in some of the work that Alison has done, I interviewed her for my Police and Crime podcast before Christmas. And you can find that if you subscribe to podcasts in your normal way, whether through iTunes or any other matters. Final question to all of you. I'll give you a couple of moments to think about this. And I do this with all of my panels and interview questions, if you've heard this before. I've walked into number 10 and I've made you minister for the day. And you have got the opportunity to make some changes to the way in which we deal with domestic abuse in this country. If you're made Minister for the day, what would you do to better support victims, witnesses and those who are experiencing domestic violence? And I'm going to come to Mark first.
Thank you very much. I think if I was the minister for the given that we have the Domestic Abuse Bill, which is now nearly through Parliament, one or two things I would say is that A, we need all of the statutory guidance with regard to the Domestic Abuse Bill to be male and LGBT plus victim friendly. I don't think statutory guidance that's drafted at the moment is. It marginalises and minimises the male experience and LGBT plus experience. And also, I would ensure that all communications and training that were not only sanctioned and spoken about by the government in terms of narrative and the training available to police forces was wholly inclusive and fit for the 21st century, that recognises female victims and male victims and LGBT plus victims. It doesn't at the moment, and we have a long way to go until we get a proper inclusive outlook with regard to the reality of domestic abuse today.
Thanks, Mark. Jacqueline, the keys have been handed over to you as the minister. What changes would you make?
Wouldn't I love that? I would want the victim placed at the center of everything that around domestic violence, domestic abuse. I think we need to listen to what the victim is saying and what the victim wants. I know that can't always be delivered, but I think too often, and particularly as service providers, we're a lot of the time we work in a way that we're trying to do the best for our victims, but sometimes we're not always perhaps listening to them. I think, people can still be guilty of thinking they know what is best for people that have experienced crime and domestic abuse in particular. I think a lot of the time we can gatekeep what we think is best for them, and I think we need to listen at the right time. But so those services need to be there to be able to listen to the victim and try and deliver or support the victim to get the answers that they're looking for. But like Henu said, just a little while ago, early intervention, support for children are in that environment, because without doubt they're the future. It's what they're seeing, what they're experiencing will go on to influence how they grow up and what type of adults they grow into because of the trauma that they've experienced. So as much early help, early intervention as possible. So they would be my two things.
Thank you. And finally, Henu.
Thank you. So yeah, again, I absolutely echo what Mark and Jacqueline have said, what they would do in for if they had the key to become a minister for the day. Unfortunately, I lived and breathe have been breathing DA in a professional capacity for quite some time now. I can't overemphasize the importance of early intervention and preventative work. And also, I think one of the good things people don't always understand is everybody wants to fund a sexy new project when it comes to DA, and it's the core work that really needs those vital money and time and effort put in to provide sustainable long-term solutions for individuals. And that's what we need to focus on, not a quick knee-jerk reaction, take the victim out, plonk them into somewhere, and then hey, we'll deal with it afterwards. It's a real package of support. If I was minister for the day, my last word would be DA has to be everybody's business, and I would make it everyone's business.
That's great, thank you. We'll try and capture that in some way and try and do something with those suggestions, because I think they're all really really important ones. Just before we sign off again, thank you to everyone who has joined us on Facebook for your contributions. Thank you to my panel, to all three of you for your insights and for all of the work that you are doing in this really important arena. Can I just come to you each one final time just to let us know where people can find out more about your organisation and the projects? We'll go Jacqueline first.
Yeah, very, very easy to find. You just search RJ Kent, Or in fact, you can go on to the PCC's website. I think there's a link through to the Restorative Justice Service. You'll get all of our contact numbers there and emails, and you can contact us through there.
Thank you. Henu?
Yep, absolutely. So if you live and work in West Kent and you need access to help and support, then you can always call our helpline, which is open 10 to 4. And if you type in www.davs.org.uk or just DAVS, you'll have access to our website and access to help through there.
Thank you. And Mark?
I think the easiest way is just to go to our website. It's got tips and tools and also a helpline number. It's mankind.org.uk. That's the best way. And I'd just like to add as well, Matthew, you've been a real leader in the Police and Crime Commissioner community on domestic abuse, not only for his podcast, but also for a number of years and supporting everyone in Kent. So I'd just like to, I think, to thank you for all the work you do.
That's very kind.
Yeah, thank you very much for your support. I mean, it would have been really tough for us to survive as an organisation if it wasn't for all the local support that we get from your officers on the ground, but also from you and your team. You've made the process so much easier, so thank you.
Well, it's very kind of you to say. Thank you very much. Well, without further ado then, thanks again all of you for your contributions today. Remember, to anyone who's watching now or listening or watching afterwards, if you need help, there is help out there. Please don't be afraid to come forward. Police and other charities will step up and support you. And as always, if you or anybody else is in danger and it's an emergency, please call 999. Until the next call, again, thank you again to my panel, and thank you everyone on Facebook. Have a great afternoon.